since the theme for the summer session is Light in Our Darkness, and has to do in part with social concerns, and we already, I think it was not last Saturday, but the Saturday before that, had this kind of open forum on social concerns when Vern Ricci was here. The suggestion was made after I'd given a kind of a little presentation on attempts at social reform in land tenure. I guess this happened when I was still living in Chicago, and Fred Hampton was, before the police shot him, asking for land. What you must give us to white people is land. And that made me look at the system of land tenure and the attempts to straighten that thing out. And I looked at it and finally wrote an essay, and really that's what happened that Saturday morning, kind of a gloomy Saturday morning, a rainy Saturday morning. We had a nice discussion on it. And John said, well, why don't you take that as the topics for your series the last week, and so that's what I'm doing. So I suggest that we look at Leviticus, and let's just keep this as a Bible study. And Bob, would you mind reading the first seven verses? We'll just go on, and what strikes you, we'll just work at it that way.
The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, say to the people of Israel, when you come into the land which I give you, the land the land shall keep a Sabbath to your Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards and gather in its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of itself in your harvest you shall not reap, and grapes of your undressed vine you shall not gather. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourselves, and for your male and female slaves, and for your hired servants, and the sojourner who lives with you, for your cattle also, and for the beasts that are in your land, all its yield shall be for food.
All right. I'm going to read two passages from an older code from Exodus 23 as parallel passages. You don't have to look them up if you wish you may, but there are 23:10 and 11, which simply say, for 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest, Shabbat, and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the wild beasts may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchards. And then a little something that's very similar to it, I won't read all of this. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and the seventh year shall go out free for nothing. And then there's some other regulations. All right, now going back to Leviticus. Anything strike you? I think that anything that strikes us is always important in biblical studies. Anything you'd like to bring to the group's attention? Something that puzzles you? What do you think is significant? What do you think is central in what was just read about this Sabbath year?
I don't quite understand how six follows from five.
Well, this has been a long sort of thing. People have said that maybe six and seven is a compromise, and a later addition, kind of a re-editing to something that was too ideal. Five simply says, to put up the point, what grows of itself in your harvest you shall not reap, and the grapes of your undressed vine you shall not gather. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. Now, if that means that they can't even take what grows, but I don't think it quite means that. It doesn't have to be a bald-faced contradiction. It's simply, you're not going to store it up. But even that is tough.
No, because you're...
Unless you eat it right off the vine and right off, go out there and rub it in your hands and chuck it into your mouth. Is that what you do? That's not clear. A lot of the legislation, there's often legal precedent, is not clear. Look at, it's presuming a little, but look at verse 20, and would you mind reading that for us there, Herb? 21 and 22, we'll tell you a little more about that.
And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, if we may not sow or gather in our crop? I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, so that it will bring forth fruit for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating old produce until the ninth year. When its produce comes in, you shall eat the old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they recognize that. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's ask a few other questions here. It's all in your mind, I think. You know, how does this work? Do you know of any other regulation, Old Testament regulation, that's similar about a Sabbath and the eating?
The manna.
Uh-huh. And how did that work?
You got double on Saturday.
In that case, it was storing it up, wasn't it?
And it didn't become rotten on Sunday. But if we tried, if they tried to save it over for another day, it did become rotten.
Yeah, sufficient is unto the day is the evil thereof, and give us our daily bread. Yeah, that business. And I think that's quite clear. And that sometimes is highly spiritualized in the manna. The manna becomes bread from heaven and all kinds of things. That isn't quite done here with the lamb, but maybe that's what's behind it. We haven't really gotten to the bottom of it yet. Why in the world does it say, in the very first thing that you read there, Bob, when you come into the land which I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. What does that mean? I know how I could keep a Sabbath. The Israelites would know how they'd keep a Sabbath.
I was struck with that too, and it hadn't occurred to me before to make the land the keeper of the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And I trust that that means the land also praises God by a rest.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have the parallels from the story of creation.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
To people keeping themselves.
It would seem as if the theology behind this is that God exists and has all kinds of blessing. And though you must do your work for 6 days and be fruitful and multiply and have dominion, the seventh day you got to stop working. And it's like Milton's famous sonnet on his blindness. They also serve who only stand and wait. Remember that? Marvelous sort of sonnet. And somehow you just have to do that. And they took this rather seriously. Where's another example of, in that case, putting it up in storage? You're very much interested in that. Storing the surplus. Well, the Joseph story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The 7 years. And when you read that part in the Joseph story, at least when I've reread it recently, my land, they were interested in economics and a good economic system so that you didn't just feed from hand to mouth. Extremely interested. So that's part of the whole business. And did they actually practice this, or is this an ideal? Is this just a dead letter that never was enforced, that the priest kind of put in and say, this is our platform for the next time, but the platform was never used?
7-year plan.
Yeah. 7-year plan. Well, there's some evidence that they did it, not only in Maccabees, but there's a fellow by the name of Achholder down here at Hebrew, in Cincinnati, Hebrew Union Seminary, who's done a lot of work on this, and a fellow in South Africa too, and they have actually figured it out. All these 49s, not 50, by the way, because this is the, like we say, Jesus rose on the third day. Well, the Hebrew way is thinking it's really on the second day, you see that? So the 50th is really the 49th, after you have 49, you know, 7 times 7, we'll have that in a minute, then comes that last 49th, which is counted by them the 50th. It's a regular Jubilee year, a regular Sabbath year, but has special connotations. That so far what Bob read is just only the Sabbath year. And that during this time, in the times of Maccabees, they lost wars. There's even a passage, why don't we look that up just a minute. Jeremiah 34, which will give you some idea of, at least as far as the slaves. Because Jeremiah, during the siege of Jerusalem, when things were really tough, thus they finally kept this law, and it says it in so many words. I'll read it really fast there. Jeremiah 34, the word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord after King Hezekiah had made a covenant with all the people to make a proclamation of liberty to them, that everyone should set free his Hebrew slaves, male and female, so no one should enslave a Jewish brother. And they obeyed all the princes and all the people who had entered into covenant, that everyone would set free his slave. So you see, it's 1 minute to midnight, and now they really finally put this into effect. And it must have been the time, see, the Sabbath time. So they obeyed and they set them free. But afterwards, that's when the pressure was off. In fact, Pharaoh came down from Egypt, and for a few months the siege was lifted. That's when Jeremiah went out and bought his family property back, by the way. And he bought it back and got it, took a licking from his cousin, because he did, it was bad price, bad time. It was a, what do they call it, a bear market. And no time to buy, but that's when he bought it. And at the same time here, they took back the male and female slaves that they had set free, and they brought them into submission as slaves. And then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah and said, "Thus saith the Lord, I made a covenant with you," and so forth. At the end of 6 years, verse 14, each of you must set free the fellow servant who been sold to you and is a servant. You say, you must set him free for your service. "But your fathers did not listen to me. And now you recently repented and did what was right in my eyes by proclaiming liberty, each to his neighbor, and you made a covenant. But then," verse 16, I'm just rushing through this, "you turned and profaned my name when each of you took back his male and female slaves whom you had set free. Therefore," verse, now the doom oracle comes in verse 17, "thus saith the Lord, you have not obeyed me, and so I proclaim you liberty to the sword, liberty to pestilence, liberty to famine." He uses that word liberty. It's a very old Hebrew archaic word, and that's the one that he uses. And so you can see what he's doing. And they must have done it. And even though some of the earlier scholars in the 19th century simply said, well, this is nothing but idealistic, they at least tried to do it. But if you ask Herb, precisely how they did it. Was it storing, or was it just eating off the land? It must have been very difficult. Those verses 20, 21, and 22 says it takes 9 years, really, to get the thing going again, doesn't it? Now, that's the ninth year. And you figure it, well, it starts at the fall of the year. You say they put your crop in the fall, and then you get it in the spring, and that's the beginning of their year. It isn't quite full 9 years, but the way they figured it. But at least it's 8 years, and you've got to wait a long time there. All right, any other observations, comments, questions? I think that's the basis of the Jubilee. It's the Sabbath, you see that? And then you'll have Sabbath of Sabbath. And you must enter into God's rest. If that's part of creation, do you remember where Jesus, when he healed on Sabbath? I think it was at John 5. They ask him, "How can you do this?" Well, he says, "My Father is working, and he works right straight through the Sabbath, and so do I." The rabbis talked about that. How in the world can he uphold the orders of creation and everything else, and why can't I uphold all this? You see that? That's what he's talking about. The rabbi's wondering, you know, why doesn't everything collapse if God takes a rest on the Sabbath day? But somehow you trusted him and walked on water whether you could or not. I think that's what they're trying to do here. Must have been a real shocker.
I believe the one thing that would really strike us a little harder would be if we could imagine that there is no preservation, no cold refrigeration and other preservation of food beyond drying it. You know, as we have today, you can eat tomatoes any time of the year. Mm-hmm. You may have to pay for them, but you can still get them. But in societies of that time, particularly where there was little transportation, they were utterly dependent upon the crop.
Mm-hmm.
You would remember the incident in New Guinea where they had a frost that killed the sweet potatoes and people were starving to death because sweet potatoes, I think, take 11 months to come to maturity.
Yeah.
And that's when they brought cabbages in, mm-hmm. because they can take some frost.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it seem from that verse 20 that we read, that you read, Herb, that God gives you so much blessing, however, on that sixth year, that you can depend on Him, and you have to learn to depend on Him.
That's right. But the degree of dependence ought to be made very clear.
Yeah. In our technological society, I think everything would break down. All we need is a snowstorm in Chicago and everything breaks down.
You know what would happen if the road would be blocked off completely? We'd starve to death. Wouldn't we?
Yeah. Well, let's go on a little farther. The plot thickens. Would you mind reading, Larry? I think we've gone as far as 7, then we interrupted 8, and continue right straight through for a long, long time, 8 to 12 at least, back to in Leviticus 25.
And thou shalt remember 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the day of atonement shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land and unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and you shall return every man unto his possession, and you shall return every man unto his family. The jubilee shall that 50th year be unto you. You shall not sow, neither reap that which grows of itself in it, nor gather the grapes in it of thy vine undressed. For it is the jubilee, it shall be holy unto you. You shall eat the increase thereof out of the field.
Yes. Now, can anyone ask me, if that happened every 7 years, why in the world must you put special emphasis on this 7 times 7 year, the 49th, or the jubilee year? The 50th one, according to their counting. Why wouldn't they blow the trumpet every 7 years? You know what I mean? And here, all of a sudden, it comes...
Were all the provisions of Jubilee also done every 7? I thought there were some that were only on 7 times 7.
That's right. So the 7 times 7 has some specific ones that were not clear in the earlier legislation. I read just some of the legislation from Exodus. It's also in Deuteronomy 15. Well, we can't really, in this particular session, look at that, but if anybody's interested in that, it's not clear whether this was for every field all across the board, but when they came to the Jubilee year, then it was clear all across the board, everything. It covers the waterfront, let's say it that way. And let's just read another little section. Would you mind reading there, Nina, is it? Yes, 13 to 17, just to give you an idea about leasing your land. Now, you see, there was rich and poor. In a sense, this is for a classless society, isn't it? Watch this. This is nothing until Karl Marx has come this radical, I don't think, in the history of my knowledge of history of mankind. Maybe there is. Just keep on here.
In the year of this jubilee, you shall return every man into his possession. And if thou sell aught unto thy neighbor, or buyest aught of thy neighbor's hand, ye shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the jubilee, thou shalt buy of thy neighbor, and according unto the number of years of the fruits, he shall sell unto thee. According to the multitude of years, thou shalt increase the price thereof, and according to the fewness of years, thou shalt diminish the price of it. For according to the number of the years of the fruits doth he sell unto thee. Ye shall not therefore oppress one another, but thou shalt fear thy God, for I am the Lord your God.
All right, so now during this interim period before the Jubilee, everything is cut off. But during that time, there are rich and poor, isn't there? Some guy goofs off and doesn't take care of things, and what happens? You know, well, he has to lease his land to somebody else, isn't it? Or has to enslave himself, something like that. That happens. And I don't think that the legislation is against that. In fact, it's quite clear, and it says you have to figure it by the income that would have come during that time. Well, let's go a little farther and give us a flavor. Karen, would you read the next part? 18, we'll make you read a long part till 24.
Wherefore you shall do my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, and you shall dwell in the land in safety, and the land shall yield her fruit, and ye shall eat your fill, and dwell therein in safety. And if ye shall say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? Behold, we shall not sow, nor gather in our increase. Then I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. And ye shall sow the eighth year, and eat yet of old fruit, until the ninth year, until her fruits come in, ye shall eat of the old store. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession ye shall grant a redemption for the land.
All right, now we've gotten the whole thing of the Jubilee here until this verse from 8 to 24. I'm going to ask this question just to be a bit provocative and a little pushy. What do you think is the center of gravity here, theologically, as far as the relationship of this to God? What do you think is perhaps the most weighty verse of all the verses we had here on the Jubilee regulation?
23.
What?
23.
23. All right, that's one candidate. Any? What do you have? Any candidates? You want to have a speech for your candidate? What did you say?
17.
All right. Not wrong one another, but fear the Lord your God. So when you have rich and poor, you still can't wrong one another. You see that? You lease the land to him, either as property or as a service, but you still can't harm one another. That's interesting. And yours, 23, why did you choose that one?
In terms of impact on people.
Mm-hmm. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, the RSV has, okay?
The land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners. All right, with me.
Yeah, what is a, sociologically in Israel, what's a stranger and what's a sojourner in an Israelite village? The Hebrew word is ger for the sojourner. Stranger is just a man who speaks a different language. Well, like Abram, when he came, you know, he was a sojourner, wasn't he? The rest of the land belonged to the Canaanites, and Abram had to kind of, there were little city-states, you see, little kinglets, and then he would make a regulation with them and use the grazing land, see? And it was a good... The Bedouin do it to this day. Well, archaeologically, I was working at Tanakh. Of the six guys working on my team, one was a Bedouin boy. And those farmers, the Fellahim, the Arab farmers, they treated him like dust because he came from the Nomads. And they had a different way. I really resisted that they would give him all the bad work. But that's sociology. He's a sojourner, you see that? And he's a stranger in the gates. He's a little different. Now, what does the Lord say here? That verse you're pointing out, I kind of agree with you here.
All of them are in that relation.
All of them are in that relation. And to whom does the land belong?
Lord,
I think that puts back to the Sabbath business. You see that? The land has the Sabbath that the Lord owns the land. You see that? And that's why you had to stop using it on the Sabbath. And since he was there... Now, there are lots of traditions behind this. Remember when Abram came there, you had these promises. I think they're authentic promises. When you're a Bedouin and you're looking for a new pasture land, that's your life, isn't it? Especially from the desert. If you're coming to the arable land, well, then you get a promise there of land. Menachem Begin has all those red lined underneath his Bible today with ink. There's a lot of them there. And yeah, that's what he talks about, right on the radio or on TV. You can hear it every day. And then when Joshua conquered it, he didn't conquer it. Who conquered it? The Lord was a mighty man of war. It was a holy war, wasn't it? And he bared forth his right hand and he would smite the Canaanites. And then when they were all through with the conquest, what's the end of Joshua with their campaigns? They allotted it, didn't they? Some of the tribes grumbled. The tribe of Joseph said, we don't have enough land for our multitudinous tribes. They had all the hassles we had, but it was all underneath this covenant relationship, you see. And so what happened then? They finally allotted with sacred lot at Shiloh all the tribes to different sections and all the clans. And we read that stuff. In fact, we don't read it, the end of Joshua. What do? We take a map, a modern map, and we say, what is that geographically? Where does the boundary go? That's not the way to read it. The way to read it is the way they said, all the good promises that God gave to the forefathers, it means to the patriarchs, he's now fulfilled. Not one of them was lost. And they don't even, haven't conquered all that land. It'll take till David to even have control of it. But somehow they promised it, you see that? So and that's the land they were living in, like my place where I grew up, Outagamie County, Black Creek, there, that farm and that section, that belongs to you, you see that? That belongs to your family, or belongs to the Indians, from which my grandfather got it. I never knew that until recently, where that came from. But now, here, once this was established, every clan had its own land as the basis of its economic existence, every family. And now this has to go back to that. Now, when was this thing upset, basically, that people didn't give it back to the families? They were all struggling to do it. Oh, the monarchy.
Monarchy.
Sure, once you got into the peak of having a standing army, then you got to pay those soldiers, isn't it? You're rather hit that and all the rest of those mercenaries. And you've got a big bureaucracy in Jerusalem, and it costs money, and that's going to knock the whole thing in the head, you see? That's why it became very difficult. They add woe unto them, Isaiah says, that add fields unto fields, you see? And the prophets will have to get in on that. But now that's getting ahead of the story a little. Let's just take two examples from the formative period of Israel. Look it up. Deuteronomy 26. When you brought the first fruits of your land, when you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance and taken possession of it, live in it, and you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest of your land that the Lord your God gives you, first grain or wheat or whatever it is, or apples, put in a basket and go to the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there. Later Jerusalem, but first, I suppose, local sanctuary. And you shall go to the priest who is in the office that time and say unto him, now notice, this is a liturgy. I declare this day to the Lord your God, this is a confession like we have in the creed, that I have come into the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord. He has to touch it to be consecrated, you see. And then you shall make a response before the Lord. In Article 1, a wandering Aramean was my father, that's Jacob, and he went down to Egypt and he sojourned there few in number. There he became a nation, great, mighty, and powerful. Egyptians treated us harshly, afflicted us, laid on us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord our God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice. He saw our affliction, our toil, and oppression. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, with a great terror, with signs and wonders. He brought us to this land. He gave us this, to this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground which thou, O Lord, hast given me. Do you notice that? That's a creed. And that's the way that was kept on. That was one way. There were several ways. The other way was with a covenant renewal festival. And look in the very next chapter in Deuteronomy 27, where Moses has a covenant renewal festival at Shechem. And he has the priests on Mount Gerizim giving the blessings. That's in chapter 28. And in chapter 27, you've got the Levites on Mount Ebal giving the curses. And just look at a few of those that have to do with social legislation. Some of them are religious and cultic, but look at verse 19 in verse 27, chapter 27, verse 19. Cursed be he who perverts the justice due to the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. And all the people have to say, Amen. You can't continue that. In other words, before you get into the church that day, you have to renew your baptismal covenant. And by the way, later on, you couldn't go up to Jerusalem unless you renewed that. Who shall stand in the holy hill? He has clean hearts and lifted up his soul to vanity. If you had been guilty of that, you couldn't worship there. Oh, there are a lot of other things that they say. Those who take a bribe, or those who take interest. All kinds of things that are mentioned here. Verse 17, cursed is he who removes his neighbor's landmark. And all the people wish to say, Amen. That was an ongoing way of keeping this thing straight. Now, what is in the next part? Well, I'm afraid we're running a little out of time, but let's just review that in the last part of chapter 25, going back to Leviticus. You have the redemption of property. It was not an inflexible system. The Redeemer, let's just look at that for a moment. Verse 25, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his next of kin shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. And if a man has no one to redeem it, then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him reckon the years since he sold it, pay back the overpayment to the man who had sold it, and shall return his property. But if he has not sufficient means to get it back from him, then what he sold shall remain in the hands of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property. It seems that Nehemiah put this into effect, or there were a number of attempts to put a lot of this into effect throughout the history of Israel, even in the pre-exilic period, not only in the post-exilic period. Where the best example you have is not right here of redeeming the property in the Old Testament. Who knows that?
Ruth.
Mm-hmm. Here there were and it's not only redeeming the property, but the family. The family had died out. There were only these women, the widows, wasn't it? And now they come back, and what right do they have? Now they get that property back, and they get it back, don't they? Nehemiah, she's a really shrewd. She knows all of her things, and she tells Ruth, you go and glean in whose field?
Boaz.
He's a kinsman, isn't it? And then when she proposes that night, by the way, in Jewish synagogues, the Orthodox synagogues, it can't be read if there's anybody younger than 40 in the audience. Mm-hmm. So, Karen, you must leave. Because she proposes. lies at his feet and says, do for me after the law of the Levirate, the kinsman. And why does he refuse the first offer? Such a nice gal.
Because there's someone closer in the relationship.
Precisely. And he has the right and the responsibility and the duty. And then, first when they go down there, in the book of Ruth, when they go down there at the village gate, and all the elders, that was the justice, wasn't it? They were there. And they said, well, now these gals have returned from Moab, and this is the way it is. Now, the nearest kinsman, tell me, are you going to marry her? And he says, sure. And all their hearts went to the bottom of their toes and their shoes, I guess. And the deal was off. Until they said, but at the same time that you marry her and raise up seed for the dead, then you've got to redeem the property. And then what does the guy say?
In effect, he doesn't have enough money to do it.
Yeah, I'm land poor the way it is. And if I have to do that, that will embarrass me, so you'd better do it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that's rather interesting. It shows how it works. So then it's on again. And then they finally praise God. And so the family is restored. And the property is restored. And by the way, and maybe I spoke too much that this is the only social organization. In New Guinea, when I taught this to the students, I said, you don't have to explain that. They understood it. They laughed in the aisles. They just said, that's the way they do it.
In different parts of the world, in India, for example, if you have land, instead of selling it, you give it out on a thing called otti. And this otti means that a person gives you a sum of money which is a little less than the value of the land. And you have the use of the money, he has the use of the land, but he doesn't get the deed to the land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, if you don't redeem it within a certain period of time, he can get the deed. All sorts of things, but it has this idea that you don't really make a final break with your hold on the land. And in Tanzania today, you know, there is no such thing as private property.
Mm-hmm.
You can build a building on the land and own the building, but the government, God, maybe,
mm-hmm.
not really, because Nyerere is a practicing Christian, but the government owns title to all the land in New Guinea, in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's ask this question. This isn't a Christian Bible. For me, the Old Testament is not just Jewish Hebrew. It may be that from Malcolm Begin, it is, but what do we Christians do with this in our Bible?
We leave it closed.
Don't tell anybody.
Don't read it.
It's a quaint custom, and of course we couldn't do that with the American Indians. They wouldn't be responsible for the way they used our land.
Someone said a 7-year plan here. Well, I think that what the Lutheran theologians, and I'm not saying this is Lutheranism in its essential or the best, would be simply say, well, Jesus has fulfilled all of those things, and today is the acceptable year of the Lord, you know, and he came there to Nazareth, and he read from the prophet Isaiah, this is the Jubilee year, you see, the year of liberty, and now this has been fulfilled in your ears. So it's all been fulfilled in Jesus, and meanwhile, you can do as you please. Laissez-faire. Is that really the way to do it? Or what do we even do with this?
We put part of it on the Liberty Bell.
That's right.
We did.
Mm-hmm. And some areas, LCA especially, to make this the theme of the bicentennial, and I don't want to disrespect that. I don't know what full effect that has had.
Mm. We make it very scientific in some segments, in terms of the land giving a jubilee. We answer that with crop rotation and fallow land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think people would see that. Mary?
I was talking with Colby yesterday about how I felt about when John and I bought a farm with another family. It was a very strange feeling to own land. It did something that I didn't like. I mean, I was happy on one hand to have it, and on the other hand, it was a very strange feeling to own something that people weren't supposed to trespass on or that was yours. And I think, to me, it speaks about really having to think twice about amassing real estate and the wealth that is in this country, or just us and our farm. I mean, I think.
Do you remember that sentence? Do you remember that sentence from the letter of the youth council that Sister Ingeborg brought to us? Some of you weren't here. Something like this: that the beginning of trouble for Christians is when they accumulate wealth for themselves and their family. Remember that? And at least in the section where I was over here, there was a lot of buzzsaws going on that.
There are some people that are trying to take a step within the system of the United States and within the possibilities of this system. It's called land trust, which I knew a little bit more about it. It means that you never could be an absentee landlord, that the people who are inhabiting that land will in essence own it. It is possible within our system to set up a trust on the land, and usually it's a collective of people who do it, but they ensure that if they move away, they don't begin to accumulate by still having title. It's whoever is working that farm, or there are people in D.C. doing it. But it'd be interesting, and part of it is from attitudes like this toward so that sharecroppers, if there are any, are owners and not an absentee landlord, and so that there are some people working on it.
How does this differ from Marxism?
You're speaking of...
It's trying to get rid of classes, aren't they? All of a sudden they wipe it out. Any of these classes that have developed and come to the Jubilee year, and it's all off again. Everything starts over. And this idea of the sacred right of private property just doesn't exist.
When you're speaking of Marxism, would you define that? You're speaking of atheistic communism. We're speaking of a theocratic understanding of the ownership of land, aren't we?
All right, so that's the difference. I suppose that's one of the great differences here. There are similarities, though, too, that we should there are very great similarities. As Sister Ingeborg said to me, yeah, that's what they always accuse us of, being communistic. she was talking a little about the results and reactions that she gets. And she said, as some of you might mention, that here in the United States, among United States youth, the call of the council gets very, very little response. The call of this letter, the second letter to the churches from these youth, from Taze, this group, gets very little response in the United States. And I suppose that we are still on that binge that simply say, this is communistic. Well, you're pointing out, how was it? Fred Hampton said, now you have to close this, but since this was the impetus to my studying this, he said something like this: you are sinning against our humanity. He said it in an ALC church in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, right in front of the altar. And somebody was badgering him and says that he had said some nice things about Mao. And some layman in the background really took exception to this. And then he spoke out. And you know, the way those guys were doing it, they have their bully men too, you know, like bouncers coming back and almost threatening the rest of the congregation. It was a very interesting sort of thing. And the rest of a group, it was Lutheran Human Relations Group that was meeting there in that church. And he said, you are sinning against humanity. And I guess what I think I said it at the spot, but I thought a lot about it. Maybe what you're saying here, Herb, is that this is an essential thing. It's sinning against humanity. He was right on that. But it's worse than that. It's sinning against God. You remember that odd thing in the old man Eli, the old priest, when his sons were doing bad things? He said, "No, nay, nay, my sons, this is no good report that I hear of you." All the things they were doing. And then he said, "If a man sins against another man, we can go to the judge, to the higher court. But if you sin against God, there is no higher court." And then God, whom you sin against, will just haul off and take you. I guess that's what Eli means there. And I'm afraid, therefore, the situation is, and in one sense, a lot worse than we imagine. It's not just a sin against humanity, but it's a sin against God and the whole covenant. And on the other hand, because it is with God, and then we have to say, what did Jesus mean? This is fulfilled. But we'll have to continue this sort of discussion here as we go on. I'm over my time.
The people we could really listen to would be the people from Latin America who are talking about some of the theology of liberation, and their whole feeling toward is this question of ownership, whether it's God or individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Larry?
I just wanted to ask a question about the resemblance or lack of it with the Marxist understanding. Are equality and equity really goals here?
I don't think so.
That is to say, and is a classless society an informed understanding, or is it a notion that there will be slaves and masters, but that over time injustices will arise, and you need some periodic returning to what is understood as a just relationship, but nevertheless it's a class relationship.
I think you're right, yes. I threw that in, somewhat provocative and evocative. So I wouldn't stand on that. On the other hand, it's closer to that than to what we ordinarily have in our understanding, and I guess that's the reason why I put it in there.
Oh,
continue this, please.